Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Lords Cricket Podcast, an Ashes special.
Well, welcome along to this Ashes special brought to you from the Lords Pavilion in association with Wisdom Monthly. I'm your host, Will Rowe, and in this episode, the birth of the urn and bodyline, we look at how one of sport's greatest rivalries was born, a love story of sorts that began at the Oval in 1882, and whether a kidnapping a few years before played any part. We'll then fast forward 50 years to the now infamous Bodyline series in 1932, when England set sail for Australia under win-at-all-cost captain Douglas Jardine, using on-field tactics so unsporting that it even reached UK Parliament as relations got to an all-time low between the two sides. To chew over all this, in the first of this three-part series, I'm joined in the MCC committee room, no less, by cricket historian and collector David Frith. Welcome, David.
Morning.
Good to have you here. And MCC librarian Neil Robinson. Welcome, Neil.
Good morning.
Great stuff. Well, opening up, we have the Times sporting obituary in front of us, an affectionate remembrance of English cricket, which died at the Oval on the 29th of August, 1882, deeply lamented by a large circle of sorrowing friends and acquaintances. Rest in peace. The body will be cremated and the ashes taken to Australia. Neil, can you set the scene? What is this obituary?
This obituary declaring the death of English cricket really vocalises the upset of the English cricketing public at having been defeated by a representative Australian side on their own soil for the first time. Just to put that in context, it was only the second test match that had been played in England. The first one had only been 2 years earlier. And England didn't have a terribly impressive record when they played representative matches in Australia. They had only won one test match in Australia before that. So it really shouldn't have been such a surprise. And on the way back from the match at the Oval to their hotel in the West End, the Australians were actually feted by cheering crowds right along the way. So it was as much a celebration as a commemoration and a grievance of the for English cricket. But nevertheless, it was an important mark in the development of cricketing relations between the two countries. And it was such a thrilling match as well, and that's really what got the whole rivalry going.
What happened in that match? I'll bring you in here, David. I mean, as a cricket historian, what happened at the Oval in 1882?
Panic, I think. Sheer panic on the part of the England batsmen. I think the target was about 85.
Exactly, 85.
And they made 77, and Spofforth the Demon was riled, and he usually was riled, but on this occasion there was the added factor that one of the Aussies, Sammy Jones, had gone out to garden, pat the pitch, and they ran him out. It wasn't a very savoury incident. He really shouldn't have gone. We didn't have television then, but you can picture it from the description that he played the ball and then went down to tap a divot. The pitch was full of divots. And W.G. raced in, ball in hand, took the bails off and triumphantly said, "We've got him." The Australians were aghast, and it probably gave Spofforth that extra edge. And it was an hysterical win, literally. It was a poor chap collapsed and died with the tension at the Oval that day.
Was a spectator in the crowd.
Yeah.
And
someone else chewed through his cane of his umbrella, the handle of his umbrella. I don't know if he died.
The umbrella did.
Well, no, it was a sensational start, but they didn't know what they were starting. No one could have looked ahead and seen what a phenomenon Ashes cricket has become. That's where it all started.
England were probably favourites to still win the match.
85 to win, by our standards, that's not much, even on a pitch that's a bit sporty. But then it was all around them were these low-scoring matches because of the uncovered pitches. Some of us happened to believe it was the worst thing that ever happened when they covered pitches, but all the same, they couldn't do it. They made 77, lost by 7 runs, and there was hysteria at the Oval and across the cables to Australia. It was a day of great joy for Australia. They'd done it. They'd beaten, they didn't call them Poms in those days, but they'd beaten the Englishmen on their own turf. And that gave a lot of edge to when Ivo Bligh took his team very soon afterwards, weeks afterwards, to Australia to see if they can get those Ashes back.
And the weather was very poor those 2 days.
Yeah.
We talk about, you know, 5-day test matches these days coming perhaps down to 4. In those days, the match finished in 2, largely because of the pitch issues and the great bowling, but also because the weather was much more conducive to bowling than it was to batting at the time. Mm.
And there was a great rivalry between the two sides, namely between W.G. Grace and Fred the Demon Spofforth.
Well,
there's
Grace
a bit of
history
to this as well.
Grace and the Australians generally, I think, going back to 1878 when there was the incident with Billy Midwinter. You referred to a kidnapping in your introduction. That might be putting it a little bit strongly, but there was certainly an issue. Midwinter was an Australian batsman who had been born in the Forest of Dean and had qualified to play for Gloucestershire through that. And he played for Gloucestershire in 1877, but come the following summer, he was also selected in the Australian touring side, so there was a natural conflict there. And the Australians were due to play a match at Lord's against MCC, and on the same day, Gloucestershire were at the Oval playing against Surrey. And Grace, you know, realising that Midwinter wasn't with the Gloucestershire team, made his way up to Lord's and persuaded him to come along to the Oval. Some of the Australians chased after him and tried to remonstrate. But in the end, Midwinter did play, not very successfully, I have to say. I think he scored 0-3 in the match for Gloucestershire. And there were strong words exchanged between Grace and the Australians, which the Australians were so upset they were threatening to pull out of a later tour fixture at Bristol against Gloucestershire, which would have been a severe hit for the funds of the county club. And Grace was forced to apologise for what he called his unparliamentary language. So it really goes back to that. Not the only people in cricket that Grace irritated from time to time.
I just wanted to quickly check on the name, the Demon. Why was Fred Spofforth given this name? I can't really pronounce that name. Fred Spofforth. Why was he given this name?
Well, I think it was partly due to his slightly demonic appearance. He had this shock of very dark hair. He was quite swarthy in his complexion. He had this droopy moustache. Think, if you like, a slightly more gaunt-looking Dennis Lilly in his pomp in the 1970s. That was how Spofforth appeared. And he had that same kind of aggression on the pitch that a lot of great fast bowlers have. Not that he was just an out-and-out fast bowler. He spent a lot of time in England cutting down his pace and bowling off cutters. He was a really skillful bowler and a very generous man off the field as well, known for giving gifts.
And he played for Hampstead alongside the great Stoddart.
So he's got a local connection here to Lords, just up
he
the road.
Has,
just
indeed,
up the road,
yeah.
Indeed, yes.
And also with this penny, he gave that to a friend, Levi Wright, who played for Derbyshire. Eventually it went to someone else, and eventually it went to Ron Yeomans, and I bought it off Ron about 40 years ago. It's a George III penny, 1773, and Bligh tossed with this in the fourth test match of the 1882-83 series, which England had already won. They'd recovered the Ashes. The fourth test, all right, they lost that, but who cares? It was actually 2-2, but England won the Ashes with the third test. And that's the coin that he used to toss. It's a great historic relic, and I treasure it. I keep it under the pillow.
I mentioned in the intro, David, that not only are you a cricket historian, you're a collector. And for the sake of listeners, as this is a podcast, can you just give that penny a little tap so they can hear it? Beautiful. So that's the penny that Ivo Bligh tossed with when he was out in Australia. And it looks like a 10p coin, not to do it disservice. It's about, just to give someone context, it's about the size of a 10p coin.
Yes.
And is it double-headed or is it a correct penny?
It has George III's image on one side and Britannia on the other.
So it's not a W.G. Grace coin?
He couldn't get away with calling woman here because on one side is a man.
Fantastic stuff. Well, so in 1882, we have the creation of essentially the mythical Ashes. The Sporting Times obituary calls it, you know, the body will be cremated and the ashes taken to Australia. But this doesn't actually exist, this little urn that listeners will be so used to seeing captains waving about. It's not until Ivo Bligh goes over to Australia the following winter that story begins.
Exactly. The idea of the ashes really started as a joke and a slight political dig at the fact that cremation was illegal at the time in the United Kingdom. And the man who placed that obituary in the Sporting Times was connected with the campaign to legalise cremation. So there was a political element to it, but it was mainly a joke, and it was a joke that caught on, because when Ivo Bligh was about to take his team out to Australia that following winter, he declared he was going out there to regain the ashes of English cricket. And Billy Murdoch, the Australian captain, with his team returning to Australia, said that he was going to defend the ashes. Now, by the ashes, they both meant the honour of their own nation as a cricketing team. So there were no ashes at first, and they only took physical form during that tour.
So, picking up the story, what happens out in Australia, David?
82-83.
Yeah. How does the Ashes come to be? It's a long story.
Yeah, England won two of the first three, so that's all they planned for. They stuck on a fourth test afterwards. But at that point, when England won the third test to go 2-1 up, that's when the ladies of Rupert's Wood presented Ivo with this terracotta urn. And it all sounds very jolly, and no doubt it was supremely relaxing. But suddenly, the girls, headed by Florence Morphy, presented him with this terracotta urn. What went into it? You can take your choice. It's thought that it was ashes from a bale, possibly from that last recent test match. In fact, a member of the family years later said, I believe it was a veil, which is easily misinterpreted as being bale. But I picked up a story 30 or 40 years ago that the maid in Cobham Hall knocked it off the fireplace. This was probably just before the Second World War. And the butler came in, was horrified. The urn might have cracked a little, but it didn't disintegrate, thank goodness. And he scolded her for her clumsiness and scratched his head and then decided to put some ashes out of the fireplace into that urn. Now, I knew a man who knew the butler, and he said he wasn't making it up. So I've accepted that. And of course, there's a reluctance at Lord's to have a forensic test on the contents. It will probably ruin everything, so let's carry on believing what we wish to believe.
But we did have it x-rayed, and the x-ray did reveal that there were a number of tiny cracks in the fabric of the urn, in the terracotta itself, which indicated that at some point it had been damaged and repaired quite painstakingly. So the story of the maid, well, who knows whether it's true or not, but there's certainly some evidence to corroborate it. There is another story. There are lots of stories about the origin of the urn, and I have to give the alternative one to Davis. There was a social match at Rupert's Wood with the amateurs of Ivo's team on the 24th of December, Christmas Eve, before the Test series even started. And some of the other stories that we have gathered from the family and from the descendants of estate workers is that the original presentation of the urn took place after that match. So it was even before the Test series had taken place and the honour of English cricket had been regained. But Lady Janet Clark, the lady of the house, felt that simply by winning this social match, Ivo's team had regained the honour of English cricket, and he should be rewarded with the ashes in some respect. And there was another element to that, of course. During that visit, Ivo had met and become very friendly with the companion of the Clark family, Australian girl called Florence Rose Morphy, who would later become his wife, and when he acceded to the title, she became the Countess of Darnley. And perhaps that urn was meant to symbolise not just the cricket, but also the bond between Ivo and Florence that was apparent already at that stage of their relationship. And certainly they kept it as a personal memento and a token of the time when they met and they fell in love. So really the story of the urn, it shouldn't ever be something that divides the English and the Australians. It should be a sign that we are together, because that's what brought them together in the first place.
So it's a story of love and unity.
It's an absolute love story, yes.
Which in the second half of this podcast, when we come to talk about Bodyline, we might disagree with slightly.
Well, I'm a bit too choked up at the moment.
There's nothing quite like a family at war, is there?
I belong to both countries, and what Neil says is spot on. It's more than just a symbol of a sporting contest. Of course, the Australians are a bit miffed that they hardly ever get to see it. In fact, for years and years, there was no chance of that. But it went out on Prince Charles's flight in 1988 for Australia's bicentenary, and it toured the country. And in Sydney, the queue went right around the block. People just wanted to gaze at this little treasure. Don Bradman saw it and claimed at the time that he'd never seen it before.
Right.
He made all those hundreds, 19 of them against England, but he'd never seen the urn. But the fact is, his memory failed him, because in 1930, his first tour, when he made those incredible 974 runs in the test, Florence was guest of honour at a dinner in London, and all the Australian players and a lot of VIPs sat around a giant table, and in the middle was that tiny little terracotta urn. So he had looked at it, but he didn't realise it. And she had about 3 years to live, I think, at that point, and she said that she would be making sure that its future was safeguarded, and she was going to give it to the club, and MCC eventually did take possession of it and have only released it, I think, on two occasions, and almost had a royal bodyguard when it went to Australia.
Yeah, I think the last time that the urn went to Australia, it had its own seat on the flight.
It did indeed. We took it. Dave was quite right. It went out for the Australian Bicentennial in 1988 and was displayed, I think, in a bank in Sydney. That was
Rural Bank, yeah.
But in 2006, for the Ashes series then, we sent it out, where it toured all the state capitals. More than 100,000 Australians came to see it, and the reactions were extraordinary. There were people breaking down in tears, saying prayers. But that's really why we had it x-rayed. We had planned to send it out there 4 years earlier, in 2003, but it was too unstable at the time. It is very old, very fragile. That's why it doesn't get carried around too much. And that's why it's never been a trophy. It's never been presented at the end of a series. All of the little urns that you see, the captains waving around in the final test match, those are always replicas. And that's a fairly recent innovation. I think it's only since 1985. David Gow was the first captain to wave a replica urn around. Before that, there was no trophy. There still wasn't a trophy till the end of the 1990s. And that led some sponsors presented trophies for the series. There was the V&G Ashes in 1986. Greg Chappell's team were presented with a silver cup in 83 when they won the Ashes down in Australia. But it wasn't until 98-99 when MCC created the Waterford Crystal Ashes Trophy. Their formal trophy, permanent for the series, was presented.
It was a lovely gesture to create that giant Waterford Crystal replica of the Ashes. But at the press conference in Sydney, I remember asking Mark Taylor, the Australian captain, did he like it? He said, I'd happily drop it and smash it to pieces.
No one has ever held... There's only one captain that's ever actually held the Ashes urn, which is Ivo Blythe.
Yeah.
No other captain has ever held it.
Mm.
And certainly there's been 90 captains of England and Australia in England versus Australia Ashes test match, hence Ashes series. But only one man has ever held it. And as you pointed out to me recently, Neil, it wasn't during the series.
It wasn't. Well, he would have handled it after the series because he took it home to Kent, but it wasn't.
He didn't wave it about.
It wasn't presented at the ground. It wasn't waved around as part of any celebration. And whether Ivo really connected the urn with the idea of the Ashes that much is debatable, because at the end of that tour, there was a farewell dinner at Melbourne, and he declared that the Ashes should be buried in a corner of the MCG and forgotten. But he obviously didn't mean the urn, because he took that back to England with him, along with his new Australian wife. So there was a separation, really, between what the urn represented at the time and what it's come to represent more than a century later.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Australians feel so strongly about this urn that one of the first things they want to do when they come to England, whether it's for an Ashes series or on a holiday, is to have a look at it. I think MCC are probably unaware that one day one of them slipped a replica into that case and has the original.
So where is the real Ashes urn? Well, we hope it's still in the MCC Museum. We presume so.
It certainly is.
A couple of Australian players. It's become so symbolic. I think in 2001, a slightly silly story, but after the Oval Test, when Australia had won that series, as they were so dominant during that period, Ricky Ponting and Colin Miller tried to burn three bales and put it into their own makeshift urn.
Yes, they in the dressing room at the Oval, they burned three bales, or tried to burn them with kerosene, but kerosene doesn't really burn at a high enough temperature to destroy wood in the way that would create ashes. So they had some rather charred bales that they kept in a plastic Colin Miller kept in a plastic container for several years. And eventually a rather lovely urn was made out of Huon wood to keep them in. And actually, we subsequently bought them at auction there in our museum as well.
Sad, isn't it?
it's a bit ridiculous, but there we have it. So that's the birth of the urn, the symbol of the Ashes, and then the real thing, a perfume jar from Florence Morphy to the then England captain Ivo Bligh. It's the beginning of one of sport's greatest rivalry. Well, right now it's time for a short break, and after that we'll discuss an Ashes series that divided opinion quite like no other. Bodyline.
The first issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, an Ashes special, is in shops from the 16th of November. To subscribe and save over £20, go to wisdensubs.com/ashes.
I'm not here to make friends, I'm here to win the Ashes. And so we start the second half of this podcast with the words of England captain Douglas Jardine. David, I'll throw it straight to you. That was a win-at-all-cost mentality there.
He told the truth. He didn't win any friends at all. Even in his home country, he divided England. There were those who thought that he damaged Empire-Commonwealth relations, irretrievably perhaps. Already there were wounds over Gallipoli 17 years earlier. And what is happening? Of course, if it had been relayed as we have test relayed today with colour television instantaneously, the British public, I think, would have seen that it was pretty unpleasant. But all they had were newspaper reports and the occasional radio bulletin, and they thought that the Australians were whinging and couldn't take it and all the rest of it. But for those who were there, and I knew quite a few who were not only there, they were out in the middle, it was a bruising, horrible summer of cricket, and many of them were unforgiving.
And this was Douglas Jardine, the England captain, set sail for Australia for the 1932-33 tour to win the Ashes, to use a form of intimidatory bowling where you would come round the wicket, pack the leg side field behind square on the leg side, and essentially look to injure the Australian batsman. You've touched on it there, talking about the kind of the political feeling. Why was Jardine sort of determined to go out there and play the game in this way?
One word, really. Bradman. Don made 974 runs here in 1930, and they thought at home he'd do at least the same total again. How did you get him out? Well, in the last test of 1930 at the Oval, he made a double century, but during the course of that match, Larwood tickled him up a bit with a few short ones. And there'd been a rain hold-up, and they went straight back out, and the pitch had been gingered up a bit. And he was batting with Archie Jackson. Archie got hit all over the place. He's a brilliant young fellow who was going to be doomed to die 3 years later. But Bradman was very uncomfortable. And although Jardine wasn't there when that happened, his friend Percy Fender was, and relayed this. And then they went to the cinema and they saw a few shots there. And the conclusion was, Bradman doesn't like it short, at the body, with all these fielders close by. They weren't as numerous then. This was part of the development of the seed of the idea. Add to the short ball at Bradman's throat the line on the leg stump, have those fielders clustered on the leg side, have a couple out for the hook or the top edge, and that would finish Bradman off.
What David said earlier about Gallipoli and the feeling that Australian, working-class Australian lads had been sent to their death by incompetent and uncaring aristocratic English commanders, that was still a festering wound, I think, in the Australian imagination. And Jardine represented that same kind of Englishness as the commanders at Gallipoli had. He, when he fielded in the deep, he was barracked terribly.
There's a story about one of the crowd shouted, "Let him die of thirst," when he asked for a drink.
That was one of the milder reactions from the crowd. I think that came from the famous Yabba, who was king of the barrackers on the hill at Sydney. Well, they got at him at every opportunity, and it was pretty obvious that he walked into this, not a trap, he knew that they'd get at him, but he was a strong man, an exceedingly strong man. He showed that in the Second World War. When he went on fighting on the continent, they had to drag him home. You're too old to be around Dunkirk and Calais when the Germans had almost reached the coast. I think people who knew him later on, I remember John Islett saying he was wonderful company, had a great sense of humour, there was warmth to him. But he also had a lot of self-discipline and bravery. He could cop it. I mean, they came back from the Bodyline Tour and the West Indians let rip at Old Trafford. He made 100 and he was badly bruised. In the Queensland match during the Bodyline Tour, Eddie Gilbert, the Aboriginal, hit him all over the place and cut him around the hip where there isn't much flesh and muscle. And he walked off. He didn't say anything to anyone, but the masseur put him on the table and looked at it and it was bruised and bleeding, and they thought, this man is tough. And when I think of Gubby Allen, who was his sort of first lieutenant, Gubby virtuously said, "I shan't bowl bodyline, Douglas." And he said, "I'll go on the next ship home." And Douglas probably was close to saying, "We'll go," but he needed him. He was a fast bowler. He said, "I will not bowl bodyline." And Bill Bowes said years later, well, of course he couldn't bowl it. He wasn't accurate enough. Yet he was happy to sit there at short legs, scooping up quite a few catches as the wretched Australians fended the ball off their faces. So there's a bit of hypocrisy about old Gubby. I remember talking to Leo O'Brien, who was a left-hander from Victoria, and he went out to bat in his first test of the series. And Jardine had all the fieldsmen over on the leg side, and Leo was a left-hander. And he said, "I'm a left-hander," thinking that they were on the wrong side. He said, "No, these are all leg-side fielders. You've got to cop it sweet. I've got here a glove that Leo gave me some years ago, signed by him, the old so-called pimple glove. That's all he had on his hands. Sometimes they put a bit of padding on their ribs, but compared to today's helmeted, cushioned batsmen, the Australians of 32-3 were exposed, very badly exposed, and there were quite a lot of injuries.
And just for listeners, the glove that you've just showed me now is... It's amazing to think that someone would face fast bowling wearing that. It looks nothing more than a sort of common gardening glove. It's almost no protection at all. It was the third test at Adelaide where things really got bad. This was when Bill Woodfull and Bertie Oldfield were hit. We mentioned at the top of the podcast, I said, there was then a cable exchange and it got to cabinet meetings at UK Parliament. What was the next sort of... what happened then? Because it was one All-In series, Adelaide. It was Harold Larwood, the great Nottinghamshire fast bowler, that was doing the majority of the damage. And, we're sitting in the MCC committee room. There was a cable sent back from the Australian Cricket Board.
Well, the cable actually reached England in the middle of the night. And the president of MCC was awoken by a member of staff at 1 a.m. The cable was slow to arrive because already Gilbert Mant, who was an agency reporter, had sent his story over to London, and the wires were buzzing hot. So by the time the Australian cable came protesting, it was a clumsy cable. It was put together chiefly by two or three men. There were some members of the Australian board weren't even at Adelaide at the time. They didn't have modern devices to compare notes in split seconds from one end of the continent to the other. Everything was very slow in those days. Even so, there were, about 18 cables went back and forth in a very short time. And the Australians' fury was quite evident to MCC, who ran the game in this country. And MCC were absolutely unresponsive, resistant, didn't want to know. But eventually, as the weeks passed, they realised there was a real problem here and something had to be done.
It was the word in that first Australian cable, unsportsmanlike, that
that's
MCC
what got the
really
Englishman upset.
Really, the very idea that MCC, one of the, according to its own credo, the most honourable institutions in the British Empire, could be capable of sending a team anywhere that would play in an unsportsmanlike manner was just unthinkable. And it really shows in the response that they sent how unthinkable they thought it.
What did they say?
Well, the first draft of this cable, this is interesting, was put together by the club secretary of the time, William Findlay, and it was really quite conciliatory. It just expressed regret at the contents of the cable. And this was put to the MCC committee, but it was amended largely, I think, by the president, Viscount Lewisham, and Sir Kynaston Studd, who, interestingly, was the brother of C.T. Studd, who'd played in that first Ashes Test match in the Oval. And the first two sentences were, "We deplore your cable. We deprecate your opinion." It was as insulting as it could possibly get. And it clearly showed that not only were they offended beyond measure by the contents of the Australian cable, they also simply didn't get it. They just had no idea, because of the difficulties of communication at the time and the fact that none of them were actually out there in Australia, none of them had seen bodyline bowling or knew what it was like. They just didn't understand what the Australians were observing and what the nature of their worries were.
And yet it had been seen in England, hadn't it, during the summer of 32, in preparation for the visit to Australia. Arthur Carr, the Nottinghamshire captain, was using Larwood and Vose with the bodyline field in the county championship matches, and quite a few casualties were listed that summer. But I think very few people realise that this was a preparation, a rehearsal for the tour down under. There's an unsung hero here. He's a little Australian chap called Robbie McDonald. He played a bit for Leicestershire, he played for Queensland, he played for Victoria, I think. He was a dental surgeon, a cricket lover. And in this very committee room at Lord's, he was cleverly putting it across that if England didn't agree to do something about this unbridled hostility of bouncers, bouncers, bouncers with this horrible leg-side field, then in 1934, if Australia came at all, they might bring four or five big, burly, fast bowlers. And that was a threat that I think straightened out some of the administrators and thought, yes, this is really, we're on the edge here.
Although, Neil, I believe you understand it was more of a gentleman's agreement, not the laws of the game that were changed at the time.
The laws of the game actually were changed in the 1960s, initially. Ordinary leg theory. 1960s saw a good deal of negative bowling at the pads, batsmen restricted from scoring. And it was that eventually led to the legislation coming in that restricted the number of fielders on the behind square on the leg side, the restriction we still have today. That formally entered the law after a couple of years of experimentation in 1970.
And just to finish on this point, you know, the fallout from the body line, when did it... It did end up in Parliament. There was a cabinet meeting. It got to that stage of, I don't want to say crisis, but relationships got so poor that this actually became political in the actual political sense.
There were political contacts in both countries. The governor of South Australia, Sir Alexander Hall-Ruthven, was actually in London at the time during the Adelaide Test, and his comptroller, Cyril Lee Windsor, cabled him to let him know what was going on, and he made contact with the Secretary of State for the Dominions, Jimmy Thomas. Exactly what communication the government had with MCC is not clear. I don't think anything's been written down. No paperwork survives, but conversations fairly clearly happened, because Thomas later said that nothing in his career as Secretary of State was so difficult and so tiresome as trying to sort out the cricketing relations between England and Australia. And similarly in Australia, the Prime Minister, Mr. Lyons, got involved as well, didn't he?
Yes, they were all in it. And the odd thing was that many of the Australian politicians were veterans of Gallipoli. And always there's this feeling that cricket is war without the bloodshed, although there was a bit of bloodshed during that Ashes, the 32-3 Ashes series. But Lord Gowrie, as he later became, was a key figure. The goings-on in the diplomatic quarters, we'll never know exactly how much it was. We picked up drifts of it here and there. But when a couple of Australian writers came over here in 82 to do a book on Bodyline, they sought to rifle, with the help of the librarian here at Lord's, through all of MCC's records. Let's find the missing documents. But they were not to be found. And the suspicion points to the weak manager of the Bodyline Tour, Plum Warner, who during the war had a big clear-out here at Lord's, and it's thought that some of the embarrassing correspondence might have been removed forever, because it was a vanity thing for a lot of people. They staked their reputations on either upholding Australia's rights or stamping out this horrible, hostile form of bowling.
Well, just to finish on that Bodyline series, and then the final section of the podcast, we'll look at the Ashes, the rivalry, and what it means. David, you knew Sir Donald Bradman. Met him, you've interviewed him. What did he tell you about that Bodyline series? Because as you said, when we started talking about Bodyline, Douglas Jardine, in your mind, it was one reason why he employed the tactic, and that was to counter the great Don.
If there'd never been a Bradman, I imagine there never would have been Bodyline. Leg theory, yes, as Neil said earlier, leg theory was as old as the hills. It was just a method of trying to get batsmen out. I was honoured to be a friend of his, admitted to the inner circle. But Bodyline, we knew exactly how he felt about it. Not much point regenerating it. He felt victimised, but my goodness, he made up for it afterwards. When they got rid of that scourge, he made almost as many runs as he did in 1930. Which is still a record. Young Don, 22 years of age, 974 runs. magnificent, so good that they devised this evil system of attack.
Well, in the final part of the podcast, I'd like to chat about the rivalry that we've been discussing for the last sort of 20, 30 minutes. The birth of the urn, Ivo Bly, the Ashes, the love story, the not-so-love story of the Bodyline series, the tactics used. It's a question for both of you. I mean, is there a greater sporting rivalry than the Ashes?
I can't think of one with more history to it. There are plenty of very antagonistic rivalries out there. You can look at India and Pakistan in almost any field of sport, but it's not restricted to Test cricket. I think if they played each other in hockey, there'd be just as much rivalry. And obviously one day cricket as well plays its part. There are plenty of rivalries, local rivalries mostly in football, but they tend to be a few hours on a single day, and then maybe there's a bit of bragging rights the next day. You don't have weeks of build-up, weeks of a series, and then weeks of bragging afterwards. The Ashes is something unique, in my opinion. I can't think of anything quite like it in the world of sport.
It's got antiquity on its side, hasn't it? It's been going for a very long time now. And nothing lasts forever, we're told, but the Ashes saga shows every sign of extending over the horizon and who knows where, until England and Australia get upset with each other again and vow never to play each other again. But that's unthinkable, isn't it?
It does feel at times almost like an in-family rivalry. I mean, David, you mentioned you're a member of both nations, but it does feel like it's almost a brother-sister-sibling rivalry at times, the Ashes.
It is. It's been said that England and Australia, the peoples, the cricket people, can be as rude as they like to each other and no real offence is taken, whereas you've got to watch your step with certain other countries and cricket teams. You have to be a bit more diplomatic. But England and Australia, you know, if anyone's had a brother, they know what it's like. There's rivalry, there's competition, there's bullying, and there's love. And I'd like to think that deep down, this is one of the very, very strong things still holding these two countries together when other phenomena are seeing them drift apart.
Thanks again to both my guests today, and thank you for listening to this episode 1, The Birth of the Urn and Bodyline, from this Ashes special of the Lord's Cricket Podcast. In the next episode, I'll be joined by former England bowler Bob Willis and Wisdom Monthly editor Phil Walker as we discuss perhaps the most iconic Ashes series of all time. Well, if you're an Englishman, the 1981 series, more commonly known as Botham's Ashes. Until then, remember to subscribe and download the podcast from all the usual podcast providers. And for more information, head to lords.org/podcast.
You've been listening to the Lords Cricket Podcast, an Ashes special.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.